When the Gods Go. Martin Buber called God the most heavy laden of all human words. None, said he, has become so soiled, so mutilated. Yet generations of men have laid the burden of their anxious lives upon this word. Truly, for thoughtful and sensitive persons, the word God has become an exceedingly difficult one to use. Someone has said, when you talk about the divine, divinity flies out the window. Now, God, of course, isn't the only difficult word. I am reminded of Aldous Huxley's statement in one of his essays. Of all the worn, smudged, dog-eared words in our vocabulary, love is surely the grubbiest, smelliest, slimiest. Bawled from a million pulpits, lasciviously crooned through hundreds of millions of loudspeakers, it has become an outrage to good taste and decent feeling, an obscenity which one hesitates to pronounce. And yet it has to be pronounced, for after all, love is the last word. Well, this is a dilemma for all of us. The sensitive person cringes from using such words as love and God. Yet defiled and mutilated as they are, can we really give them up? Aldous Huxley's brother, the equally brilliant Sir Julian, in his Revision of Religion Without Revelation, has this important word for us. The religion of the future must have as its basis the consciousness of sanctity in existence, in common things, in events of human life, in the gradually comprehended interlocking whole revealed in the human desire for knowledge, in the benediction of love and beauty, in the catharsis, the sacred purging of the moral drama in which character is pitted against fate and where even the deepest tragedy may uplift the mind. Let me make it clear then at the outset, whether a man names it God or leaves it nameless, he who lives in the consciousness of sanctity in existence, sensitive in his awareness, morally in earnest, finding his miracles in the commonplace and his marching orders in the mysterious imperative of his own ethical will. This is the religious man, whether he calls himself a Catholic or an atheist. Let me make clear also that it may make a world of difference whether or not a person puts the article A in front of the word God. This is an age sometimes called twilight, the twilight of the gods. Assuredly, I believe this to be so. Man has lived with his many gods for many centuries, but slowly and surely the gods die. Emerson, you know, put it pithily when he said, "When the half-gods go, the gods arrive." This may be considered the history of religion in an epigram. The Bible is many things, but for one thing, it is a biography of the gods. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is not the God of Isaiah or of Jesus. The God of Moses, Yahweh, is a jealous tribal deity, a thunder god on Mount Sinai. In Genesis and Exodus, we are a long way from Jeremiah and Hosea and Job and the later Psalms. God, we read in the New Testament, is love, and he that dwells in love dwells in God, and God in him. The biography of the gods has many chapters besides those written in the Bible. It is the story of animism, the many spirits of primitive man. Here we find the magical incantations of the medicine men, frank efforts to bargain with the spirits, to bribe and to placate them. Out of animism, polytheism gradually emerges. We find the gods of Egypt, half human, half animal. And we find the more familiar Greek and Roman deities. But these, like the earlier spirits, are still capricious deities, very human, often unmoral. These are appropriately called half gods, because any god that does not make real ethical demands is truly only half a god. Were these half-gods real? In one sense, yes. They were the genuine product of human minds. They were real, subjectively real, to those who believed in them and who worshipped them. They stood for something, but they existed only in men's minds. When men outgrew them and stopped worshipping them, they simply faded away. The half-gods were capricious and undependable because men experienced life as unpredictable, uncertain. Any god is a reflection of human experience. When the half-gods go, the gods arrive. We trace the arrival of more adequate thoughts of God in the Bible. Amos, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Micah, all denounced idolatry and the running after other gods. All pleaded for fidelity to Yahweh. It is clear that the Jews, for a long time, were tempted to the worship of other gods and believed that their God was but one God among many. And such is the transition period from polytheism to monotheism, a transition, one might add, far from complete even to this day. You have your God, other people have theirs. If you keep on good terms with your God, he will defend you in battle, make your crops prosper, bless your days. But if you break his commandments, he will punish you, even allowing you to be defeated in battle and carried off into slavery. For the Jews, the crisis evidently came when they were carried off into exile in Babylon. There they were helpless, outside the territory of their own God. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? They wailed. The unknown prophet of the exile had an answer for them. God, he said, is far greater than you think. He is not the God of the Jew alone, but of all peoples. Why sayest thou, my way is hid from the Lord, and my judgment is passed away from my God? Hast thou not known, hast thou not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, is the creator of the ends of the earth. After these words had been spoken and had burned themselves into the hearts and minds of a suffering people, then was achieved at last the recognition that there is but one God to be worshipped, one author and sustainer of nature. Before our eyes, as we read these ancient texts, there emerges a truly glorious conception of God, one who cares nothing for burnt offerings and the blood of bullocks, and who demands instead that men do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly. A universal God, no longer tribal, nor even partial to one people. For in the words of the modern jazz spiritual, he holds the whole world in his hands. Now, thus God seemed to Jesus, the child of Judaism. He was no longer one of the half-gods, for now the gods had arrived. Yet though this was a magnificent conception of God, it was still a creation of the human mind, this mind that is forever manufacturing gods. With Christianity, the religion about Jesus, whose chief architect was Paul, another of the great concepts of God arrived. For the God of the Christians is a triune God. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Disturbed by man's incorrigible sinfulness, God determines on a remarkable means of reconciliation. He will send his only Son and allow him to be crucified. A few centuries later, another of the gods arrived. His name was Allah, and Muhammad was his prophet. He succeeded the half-gods of the Arabian Peninsula, and, gathering momentum, his armies swept over the Mediterranean world. For several centuries, it looked as though this latest arrival might well conquer the triune God of the Christians. But the Islamic fires began to die, even as Christianity had lost its own initial fervor, and a kind of balance of power was achieved. And ever since then, save for the Crusades, tragic misadventures, an uneasy truce has been maintained between Christendom and the Islamic world. Yet even today, Islam converts more persons to its worship of Allah than Christianity wins to Christ. In this competition of the gods, we need to recognize that all man's gods are his own manufacture, like the half-gods whose places they inherit. The gods represent pre-scientific man's best efforts to come to terms with reality and to achieve an understanding of existence. Insofar as they were thought to embody noble attributes and to demand of their worshippers the sort of ethical sensitivity and responsibility set forth, for instance, by the Hebrew prophets, there can be little doubt of their ennobling influence upon human history. For many centuries, the gods proved adequate. The God of the prophets for the Jews, the triune God for the Christians, Allah for the Muslims, and for others still other gods. But we seem to have come at last to the point where the gods, too, are going. There really is no place anymore in this universe for a God who is made in man's image, who is conceived as a greatly magnified man. This comes increasingly unreal to us, as unreal as the location of heaven or hell. And not to us only, millions of Muslims are Muslim in name only. Disillusioned and dispirited, they drift away from the worship of Allah. So with a growing multitude of non-practicing Jews, and with the many millions of nominal Christians, they drift away because they are asked to subscribe to myth as though it were history, to poetry as though it were science. And it would not seem likely that there could be any significant reversal of this. The God who is separate from, above, and beyond this world is a concept increasingly untenable for thoughtful men. Now, this was acknowledged by such an eminent theologian as Paul Tillich, who in his truly heroic endeavor to save Christianity began by admitting what we have just been saying. Ordinary theism, he wrote, has made God a heavenly, completely perfect person who resides above the world and mankind. The protest of atheism against such a highest person is correct. There is no evidence for his existence, nor is he a matter of ultimate concern. The gods, Tillich is saying, against which the atheist protests, do not indeed exist, so far as we or any man knows, but this is not the end of the matter. The atheist does not have the last word. He has a function to perform, that of midwife. He clears the way for a larger thought of God, for those who have the imagination and courage and maturity for this journey. For the crucial question is not, is there a supreme being called God? But where is the proper focus for man's worship? What ought to be our ultimate concern, our final allegiance? Today, the gods follow the half-gods into oblivion. As Tillich, to quote him once again, put it, the God who is a being is transcended by God who is being itself, the ground and abyss of every being. But what on earth, you say, does this mean? Simply this. As in Greek religion, you will remember, fate was above Zeus, determining him and his decisions, so God, as being itself, is that which lies beyond all the gods. He is what the Hindus call Brahman. Today, as Tillich put it, if you start with the question, does God exist, you can never reach him. For God is not a being, not even the highest one. The atheistic protest against such an assertion is justified. God, as a being, is below being itself. Like fate behind Zeus, he has something above himself. And therefore, he is an idol. The fight against this idol is the theological truth of atheism. So, Tillich, and others who think like him, brings us to a fundamental parting of the ways. This is the bridge which mankind must cross. We can elect to use the word God, but only if we frankly and clearly state that when we speak of God, we are only using analogies and metaphors, allegories and myths. We can escape idolatry only by recognizing this fact. For to talk of God, to try to define, to name appropriate attributes, is inevitably to limit, to make God finite. And the finite God is inevitably an idol. Is this a tragic discovery to have made? I do not think it needs to be. Now we are ready to carry Emerson's thought a step further. When the gods go, man arrives. Indeed, until men stop thinking of God as a cosmic helper, a supernatural ally, a heavenly father upon whom they can lean and thus remain children, they cannot take the next step, moving beyond conventional theism and conventional atheism alike to the God who is behind all gods, the God who is not a being, but being itself, who is not a person, but the ground of everything personal, who is not the creator of heaven and earth, but the rampant, extravagant creativity of the cosmos itself. We should never again need to ask, is there a God, as though God could be something outside of nature, outside of ordinary experience, something foreign to ourselves. Rather, we should phrase the question, what is it that you and I experience when we acknowledge the claims of truth and justice and love? For the time has come for man no longer to lean on God, praying for favors, asking for miracles. The time has come foreseen in the Talmud long ago, where we read, in days to come, all prayers shall be abolished, save prayers of thanksgiving. Supernatural gods, heavenly beings, demanding our prayers, our obedience, in return for their protection and their favors, the time has passed for these, even the loftiest of them. But when we have put aside the gods who are idols, there is still what Huxley calls the consciousness of sanctity in existence. In the unceasing creativity of nature, in the opulent beauty of the visible world, in the riddle of evolution, in the remaining mysteries of life and consciousness, of memory and imagination, we still confront that which caused our long-ago ancestors to manufacture their gods. And deep within ourselves, we discover what Schweitzer called that mysterious ethical will, this inexplicable fact that we experience the tug of ideals and know ourselves to be morally accountable. It is this sort of thing I mean when, hesitantly, I use the word God. I hesitate because I know how easily the word becomes not a signpost pointing us beyond the limits of feeble thought, but a kind of curtain obscuring the reality we grope for. This God behind all gods may sound distant and abstract, and it is true that he will not do for me what I ought to do for myself. He will not give me what I must myself achieve. He will not coerce me into goodness, either by promise of reward or threat of punishment. Even to speak of coercion to goodness is a contradiction in terms. Yet is God the most present of all experiences. It was our ancestors who projected God into a mythical heaven, setting him upon an imaginary and very distant throne. For me, for those like me, God is returned to this earth, becomes a present experience. This inescapable God is what Walt Whitman wrote about, saying, "Why should I wish to see God better than this day? I see something of God each hour of the 24 and each moment then. In the faces of men and women, I see God, and in my own face, in the glass." You have often heard me define religion as a man's love affair with life. To me, all life is, at least it ought to be, considered as sacramental, all nature a temple, every meal a communion service. To me, the true church is the community of those who seek the way of love, who do justly love mercy, and walk humbly in this all-encompassing mystery of being. And if you are endeavoring to walk in the consciousness of sanctity and existence, I don't greatly care whether you use my name for it or not. I do care that you understand what I am trying to express, and that you recognize that such a concept of God is one which encourages men to responsible, self-reliant maturity. For it teaches that the purpose of individual life is, at one and the same time, to realize self-fulfillment and to transcend self-centeredness. That we are to be most fully and uniquely ourselves, and yet are to overcome all alienation, separation, estrangement from God who is being itself, the God behind all idols. With Walt Whitman, I say, the whole earth and all the stars in the sky are for religion's sake. I say no man has ever yet been half devout enough. None has ever yet adored and worshipped half enough. None has begun to think how divine he himself is. Inquiry, earnestness, and empathy. In these three nouns, it seems to me, we can find a comprehensive shorthand answer to the question, what is it to be a good Unitarian? Or if you prefer, as I really do, to avoid a national label, how should we define what it means to be a religious liberal? Some of you may be familiar with the book written some 17 years ago by my father, then in his 80th year, to which he gave the title, The Religion of an Inquiring Mind. My filial pride, no doubt, affects my judgment, but I continue to regard this volume as one of the better expositions of religious liberalism. But for now, it is only the title that concerns me. To be a religious liberal, one must indeed possess an inquiring mind. Inquiry, as we so frequently stress, demands freedom. The freedom to search for truth, the freedom to change your mind, the freedom to differ with your neighbor. So in this church, we guarantee each member's right to think for himself, faithfully to follow the monitions of his own conscience, to speak plainly his own conclusions. And not his freedom only to do this, but his responsibility, his obligation to do so. We say this often, but I repeat it without apology. We cannot afford to take free inquiry for granted. For freedom of the mind is not only precious, it remains an altogether too rare and fragile thing in this world of gigantic issues and turbulent change. We speak now not of political institutions or educational institutions, but of how rarely we find it among man's religious institutions, any that foster and guarantee free inquiry. For Islam and Judaism, no less than Christianity, are revealed religions full of commandments that carry supernatural authority. All stress the sacredness of tradition and insist upon conservation of the faith of the fathers. Membership rests upon the acceptance of a creed, however liberally interpreted, and the acceptance of the authority of some other person or body, some ecclesiastical group, but other than oneself. This faith of ours, taught by no priest, but by our beating hearts, is virtually unique and very little understood by others. We are forever being told by those who we think might well know better that Unitarians are folk who don't believe this or don't believe that. How seldom does anyone outside our own ranks describe our movement as we ourselves think of it, not in terms of its negations, but of its generous, daring affirmations, its faith in human dignity, its effort to create a church truly Catholic, Catholic with a small c, that is, truly open and universal, precisely because it is based not on a set of revealed commands, one of a number of such competing systems, but rather upon open-minded seeking and independence of judgment, on the willingness to stand on one's own feet, to tolerate doubt, to respect differences of opinion, and to allow within the church plenty of psychic space, plenty of elbow room. And why do we insist upon such freedom? So that truth may be honored, so that the same method of acquiring better answers, truer answers, which has worked so effectively in science and all other areas of human knowledge, may be applied to man's religious quest. "Whoever knew truth put to the worse in free and open encounter," wrote John Milton in his Areopagitica, and so we insist. Hence for us, sincerity and integrity are pivotal virtues, not because they are more important than such virtues as courage or kindness or gratitude, but because lacking sincerity, lacking integrity, all other virtues become false and phony. So in Unitarian Universalism, we stress free inquiry. Inquiring minds are one of its few basic requirements. We do not claim to be smarter or brighter than others. Most of us are endowed with fairly average intellects. However, what we have, we feel obligated to use as best we can. But freedom to inquire is not all there is to religious liberalism, not by a long shot. Freedom may be our method in religion, but it hardly supplies the full content. So let us turn to the second noun, earnestness. Here again I am reminded of a book title. Robert Collier, a noted Unitarian minister around the turn of this century, a vigorous and noble spirit, once wrote the biography of a fellow Unitarian, and he called it A Man in Earnest. Without this quality of earnestness, one has very little religion worthy the name. One of the more important questions for us to ask ourselves is whether from this base of free inquiry, we are actually able to develop a homegrown religion characterized by a true seriousness, a devotion and loyalty to great ideals. Can we generate the sort of compelling dedication that characterizes creedal churchmen at their best? Can we be men in earnest to change lives, our own lives, and through the power of contagious enthusiasm and example, others also? Can we be men deeply committed to the task of changing those things in society which thwart the hopes and dreams of many? Religious liberals are often criticized at precisely this point. We are ineffective, it is charged. We are but dilettantes in religion. Our churches only societies of sophisticated, self-satisfied folk. Our Unitarianism but a watered-down Christianity. If what is meant by watering down Christianity is only that we have abandoned many of the historic doctrines and dogmas of the church, we can put the criticism aside as irrelevant. Of course, we have had to abandon much. Intellectual honesty gave us no choice. But if what is meant is that we lack the kind of earnestness, the esprit de corps, that marks the truly religious person, this is indeed criticism to take to heart. So, let us be sure that we understand. No man is a religious liberal worthy the name simply because of his rejections. Those who abandon Orthodox Christianity or Orthodox anything don't necessarily become Unitarian Universalists or religious liberals. Alas, they usually simply swell the army of the uncommitted, the undecided, the unconcerned, the large company of those, however decent they may be personally, who go through life eating and drinking, getting and spending, laying waste their powers, leaving unasked the ultimate and significant questions about the meaning of their existence and their proper relationship to other human beings, to other forms of life, and to the ultimate source of all being, the nameless power who, for want of a better name, we call God. Let him then who would call himself a religious liberal recognize that he needs to possess more than an inquiring mind. He must be a man in earnest, a man of commitment. He must have, as the Quakers put it, concerns. He must take life seriously and have learned, to paraphrase Wordsworth, to look upon the world not as in the hour of thoughtless youth, but hearing oftentimes the still sad music of humanity, nor harsh nor grating, though of ample power to chasten and subdue. Antioch College has me on its mailing list for its periodic publication, Antioch Notes. A recent issue honors its 92-year-old president emeritus, Arthur E. Morgan, and contains a number of brief quotations from Dr. Morgan's recent volume, Aphorisms and Observations. Resisting the temptation to quote extensively, let me read just one sentence that ties especially well to what we are now saying. A large number of people, writes Dr. Morgan, have very empty lives because they do not care enough about life to pay the price for great living. Those of you who have followed the career and the writings of this great American educator and public servant know that he has been one to experience a full life because he has cared deeply enough about life and about people never to hesitate generously to expend himself or to take risks to comfort and reputation in the pursuit of his ideals. Being a true religious liberal, then, means being a person willing to be involved in mankind. A person caring deeply enough about life to pay the price for great living. Such earnestness may lead one young person to join the Peace Corps, or to become a conscientious objector, or a draft resister, or it may lead a suburban housewife to volunteer for work in a hospital, or a Planned Parenthood clinic, a daycare center for children of the poor. Well, but these are only random samples of the myriad types of involvement to which being in earnest will naturally lead. The person who takes life seriously will go to the polls to vote, despite great personal inconvenience. The person who cares deeply about life will manage that visit to the lonely older friend in danger of being forgotten in some nursing home. The person who is in earnest will actually get round to sending that letter or telegram of commendation or criticism to the appropriate public servant. And the listing of such illustrations, of course, might easily be continued. The specific forms of action are less important than the general attitude that informs them. Already, as we push this matter of earnestness, of involvement and concern, we have crossed the boundary and are speaking as well of our third noun, empathy. Now, empathy is not a word we ordinarily use. In fact, you will not even find it in some of the smaller and less adequate dictionaries. The familiar word, also a fine one, is sympathy. But there is a difference between the two, a small difference. Sympathy is literally feeling for or with another person, while empathy literally means in feeling, and thus goes a little further than sympathy. In the autobiography of that common sense American saint, Dorothy Day, founder of the Roman Catholic worker movement, and a true contemporary of St. Francis of Assisi, we read this: "Solitude and hunger and weariness of spirit, these sharpened my perceptions, so that I not only suffered my own sorrow, but the sorrow of those about me. I was no longer myself, I was man. I was no longer a young girl, I was the oppressed. I was that drug addict, screaming and tossing in her cell, beating her head against the wall. I was that shoplifter who, for rebellion, was sentenced to solitary. I was that woman who had killed her children, murdered her lover." Now there you have an excellent definition of empathy. Sympathy, yes, but sympathy lifted to the level of imaginative identification. To be a religious liberal, to be a religious person, this is more than a matter of thinking and believing, being in earnest, and involved in good causes and worthwhile activities. It is also to have empathy, this power of imaginative identification. It is the willingness not only to feel sorry for another, but to be that other. It is the ability to see ourselves as others see us, and to see others as they see themselves. Are we willing? Are we willing? We comfortable middle-class Americans, to make the effort to see the world through the eyes of an unemployed Harlem youth, or a nearly illiterate Mississippi sharecropper, or an Arab refugee, or a South African Bantu, or a Vietnamese villager. Are we able, we opulent Americans, to put on the shoes of those who literally have no shoes, and to feel to the marrow of our bones what it is to experience the increasing disparity between America's wealth and their own bitter, life-destroying deprivation? Empathy, one of man's greatest assets, potentially, but forever in meager supply. Take all today's talk about crime in the streets and law and order, about rebellious youth and black agitators, about beatniks and hippies and all the rest. Does it not reveal how little empathy most of us have, how unwilling most Americans are to attempt even to make creative identification across the affluence-poverty gap, across the generation gap? how few really try to understand the anger and the frustration that sometimes erupts into violence, or the disillusion and the impatience that sometimes lead to student defiance and even civil disobedience. Certainly riots and looting and all other forms of lawlessness are not to be condoned, but the problems of which such things are the symptoms are not going to be solved by harsh repression or by so-called righteous indignation. Solutions come only after there is understanding of the causes and willingness to attack the problems there. Judge not, that ye be not judged, said Jesus. I know of no more important text for all of us today who share America's burgeoning prosperity and yet virtually refuse even to explore our urban ghettos and slums, or really to look into the faces of the wretched of the earth. Empathy, earnestness, inquiry, what a vital and essential facet of the religious enterprise each of these nouns represents. Free inquiry, how important, yet only if it opens the way to other things, a heart that understands and to a will that motivates. Let us then, who call ourselves religious liberals and Unitarian Universalists, make clear that by this we intend to be persons who cherish free inquiry, but equally who take life seriously, with clear and well-defined involvements and commitments, and who live as defenders of the mystery and holiness within man, as affirmers of his dignity and of the sacredness of life, and the right of every child of earth to a fair share of God's sunlight.